Okay, everybody, welcome. I hope you can see the screen and give me just a thumbs up that you're seeing the PowerPoint. Terrific. Okay, and my face. Yes, the video is coming through. Good. One of the great things about giving a series is I get a chance to go back and make a few corrections. So I'm going to start with that. People both in the chat box and afterwards shared a few points that I really were valuable, and I want to make those corrections now. The other thing I'd like to do is the same sort of format as last time, which is we're going to save questions to the end. So please do put them up in the chat box, and we'll save a few minutes at the end of the class. Go over that way, but I'm going to kind of lecture straight. I haven't yet managed the Yeshuva Dat to be able to go back and forth with the chat box. And so I'll make my presentations and we'll come back to it. Errata. I had said that the representation of the Eitz HaDaat was apples in the Sistine Chapel, and I was corrected. It is, in fact, a fig. The fig is the most pshat of the options, because the only fruit to be mentioned in Gan Eden is the fig leaves that were used to make their chagurot, to make whatever garments they made out of that. So fig is an obvious choice. However, I stand by the point I was making, which is really throughout medieval Christian iconography and pictures, the apple was used quite often, probably more often than the fig. And that is because the point I was making, the generic fruit, if you just say fruit, in the mind of your average European would be an apple. And that is the point that I was trying to make, that the plain, simple fruit, what jumps to mind when you say fruit, could be lots of things. And in that case, it was the apple. I also said Ha'adam was mentioned with the definite article in chapter 2 for the first time. And I was corrected, it was in chapter 1. But the general point about the point of Ha'isha, the definite article being attached and its significance, I won't repeat last year's shiur. It still was in that pasuk. So thank you for that. And etymology is not entomology. Thank you, Rachel. I mentioned something about a derivation of a word and called it the study of insects, and I want to correct that. Onwards. I'm going to repeat a few of the things that I said last time, introducing it only because this year, I think, is even more fraught than last week's. We're talking really about the question of gender, and it is fraught and sensitive. It's a highly charged topic in today's world. And more than anything, I really need to ask you for your generosity, which means a lot of people, myself included, listen to this sort of talking and instruction and will say, is this person part of the problem or part of the solution? And if they're not part of the solution, then they're definitely part of the problem, meaning there are two sides. It's binary and you have to pick one. We are celebrating the Barbie movie, which is filled with all kinds of gender politics and anger around it. I'm going to say things that hopefully are complex and nuanced, but are in certain ways admitting or explaining some of the androcentric, male-centric parts of the Torah and why that might be, and trying to give it logic. So listen to the end. I'd be really interested in pushback if you have it in the chat group, but allow me to make the thesis and hold off any premature conclusions. Again, we will be using gendered language. There was a point last time when I translated Adam as man and not human. And again, I stand by that, and this class will really explain why. Will continue to adopt the heteronormative frame. That is the frame that the Torah uses, and Judaism, I would say, speaks from within. And I again acknowledge it might not be shared with everybody in the audience over there, but it will be the frame that I am adopting. We're going to talk open and directly about sexuality. And again, we'll be making comparisons and analogies. And we're going to be careful to recognize that they don't mean to equate things. We're just comparing things. Okay, onwards. Gender. As many of us know, gender is composed the story of gender is really two stories of creation and how those two stories go together. Rabbi Soloveitchik and his Lonely Man of Faith made a whole thesis about this, and we'll be using some of his distinctions, but not really repeating his thought. So, chapter one. Chapter one says as following. God says, let us make man in our image. And right away, the Mefarshim jump on the fact there's an us here. Bitzalmenu, in our likeness. What's this plurality is attached to God? It's obviously very difficult. And in some of the translations, the rabbis were careful to remove it so as not to create any sort of idolatrous notions of multiple gods. But the plurality is there. The classic Mefarshim say God consulted with the Palmalia Shalmala, the heavenly retinue, the angels that were there, or it's the kind of a royal we showing a certain humility. But that plurality is there. And my thought here in kind of looking at it is it actually reflects the plurality in the creation of man, which we'll see in a moment. And this man will rule over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the sky, over the animals, over all the earth. Onwards. God created 27, man in his image. In Hebrew, Yivra Elohim et ha'adam bitzalmo, bitzelem Elohim bara oto, zachar unekeva bara otam. A very complex verse. God created man in his image. It's the masculine form there, his image. In the image of God, he created oto, meaning this creation, Adam, is also in the generic male. However, zachar unekeva, male and female, he created them. There's a plural and a singular in this very same sentence. And we're going to try and figure what's going on with that. God blesses them and says to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill up the earth, conquer it, and rule over the fish and the fowl of the heavens and the animals that creep upon the earth. So God creates the first commandment in the Torah, be fruitful, multiply, have children, which is a commandment on every Jewish home. And it's addressed to this Adam here, Zachar Nekeba. Now, we won't get into it very much here, but the rabbis, Darshan, they read a homily here and say, what is this conquering? This conquering in this pasuk is a male activity. Conquering kivshuha, to conquer, is a male activity. And therefore, the bulk of this command to be fruitful and multiply also falls to the man. Why? It is the nature of man to pursue. And so he will be the active party in searching out a mate. So you have, on one level, mutuality, zachar unekeva. You have a plural, otam. And yet there is already some kind of leaning one way or leaning another way. It's not simple to say that man is commanded in fruitful and multiply and women are exempt. It's much more complicated than that, which we won't discuss today. But there are ways in which it is distinct. When a man's obligation is not the same as a female obligation, and there are real halachic ramifications of that. One, for instance, is a woman, in certain instances, may be more permitted to use birth control than a man, because she's not contravening or canceling the same level of obligation. Okay, that's chapter one. Zachar unekeva, male and female, he created them. Chapter two. Hashem, God, formed man from the dust of the ground and blew into his nostrils a breath of life, and the man became a living being. Hashem, God, planted a garden in Eden to the east, and he placed there the man whom he had formed. Only in the singular, a singular Adam who is placed in a garden. In between, there's a break in the text, and the garden is described with the four rivers, and then we come back to this creation narrative. Hashem, God, took the man, placed him in the garden, to work and watch it, and that's distinct from conquering. We have a much sort of softer language here, protective as opposed to developmental, and that's, again, part of Rabbi Soloveitchik's piece. Hashem, God, commanded the man, saying, from all the trees of the garden you may freely eat, but from the tree of knowledge of good and evil you may not eat, because on the day that you eat from it, you will surely die. So where man was commanded, Adam was commanded in the first pasuk, go out and conquer, develop. Here he's being told, refrain, hold back in a certain way. Hashem then says, it's not good for man to be alone. I will make for him a helper to be his counterpart. In Hebrew, those words are ezer kenegdo. And right away, the creation of the female, of Isha, is being set up in a relationship model. A help and against, a counterpart, which is a really good mention. We're going to make much of this relational together and opposed piece of ezer kenegdo. Again, there's a break in the text. In the meantime, God creates animals. He brings the animals one by one to Adam. Adam names them. He can't find anyone that's fitting for him. And then the creation of woman happens only after the loneliness of Adam, his lack is being demonstrated. He feels it. He has not found, he cannot find anything to meet him. And in that loneliness, in that space of want, of desire, the following creation takes place. Hashem, God, cast a deep sleep upon the man, and he slept, and he took one of his, in Hebrew, mitzalotav, tzela is the word in Hebrew, and one translation is ribs, but it's by no means the only translation. We'll talk about that. But I just want to point out the English ribs is one possibility. Then that place where the absence was created was filled with flesh. Hashem then takes the rib and builds it. That verb to build is going to be significant. It's an interesting verb to say in creation. Man has been formed and woman is built. Then he brings the man, the woman to the man. And the man said, this time this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. This will be called woman because this was taken from me. Again, we have this composite, a body, something is removed, and the lack and the connection and the difference between them is all being expressed in this version. Very different than chapter one, where we have simply male, female, side by side, parallel, created. Here, something is removed. There's a lack. There's a building. We go on. Following the story, the Torah says, why? Why tell you this story? And the answer is, man has to leave his father and mother, meaning man and woman were part of something, their home. They have to, again, leave, create an absence, a lack, extract themselves from their home, and then cleave to each other, find each other. And they become, in that, lebasar echad, a single flesh. Rashi there says, what's the single flesh? It's the children that they create, which are combinations of both of them. It's interesting. We often think about relations in krovim, relatives, as being descendants, right? There's a single great-grandfather, and relatives are all the people that descend from that person. But I'm very privileged and blessed to have a grandson. My daughter married the boy next door, a family here in the town where I live in Alon Shvut. And this lovely family that I knew only as acquaintances who davened in shul not far from where I sat, all of a sudden, this man is grandfather to the same child that I'm grandfather to. I share the title of grandfather through this child. In other words, Basar Echad also joins people from bottom upwards. We are joint grandfathers. Our families have come together because we have common descendants, which is an interesting point. Okay, they were both naked. Adam v'ishto, they're named as a couple here. Ha'adam v'ishto together. V'lo yidbashashu, and they were not ashamed. We'll make this point a lot in this series, but sexuality is nothing to be ashamed about. Their nakedness was not to be ashamed about. It was only because of things that unfold afterwards, which we won't address, more what we did last time. But their nakedness, their bodies, their genitalia, there's no reason for any of this at this stage to be a cause for discomfort. Okay, but we're going to go back. And we're going to talk about Yivin v'tzela. So yiven v'tzela, this building of the tzela to form a woman, suggests something that actually I think was mentioned by someone in the last class, that someone mentioned that tzela could mean side. And yes, indeed, in the creation of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, the sides of the Mishkan are called tzela. And also, the Mishkan is built. The verb of building things refers to the Mishkan. It's a building. And what I'd like to make of this is the sense that in woman is the creation of an interior space, is the place in which a child gestates, literally, and then is born from, and then the home. The whole structure that is meant to protect and develop and nurture the child is primarily the feminine space. So that the building of containers, the building of sides, is alluded to in this yiven tzela, building of a side. Okay. How do you put the two together? How do we reconcile chapter one, where Zachar and Nekeva, there's this composite, and chapter two, where there is a Adam and then a Isha, which happens, is taken from it. So different ways of doing it. Ramban sort of says that the general creation was made in chapter one, and the sort of details were in chapter two. There's a famous midrash, which is on the screen in front of you, and says that the original creation, the original Adam of chapter one, was made with two faces, one male and the other female, du partsufi. And it's also interesting that the geo partsuf is a Greek word, duo, Deuteronomy, right? And there's certainly this idea of the double faced being is something which existed in Hellenistic literature. And the distinct way the rabbis talk about it is something that I'd like to mention. The pasuk which is marshaled in support of this is a pasuk which said, Achor v'kedem tzaratani, forward and back, you have formed me behind and before. A verse from Psalms. And so somehow I've been created with a front and a back, two sides. And that duality is being expressed here perhaps by these two faces. Why? Because it's created v'yiven Hashem Elokim et tzela. Rav and Shmuel argue maybe this tzela is not a face. That's the opinion of one of them. Or perhaps it's a tail. So that what happens is there's some composite being created in one, containing within it male, female. By chapter two, this composite being is separated. So the male parts are here and the female parts are here and they come together. This is a big yesod in the Kabbalah. It's called Sod HaNisira, the secret of the sawing, the way that something which was held contained both things in it are separated to create these two halves. What the halves are before and after is this debate. Was it a face that was taken and created the woman, or was it a tail? And what everybody is detecting, I'm sure, and maybe even bristling a little bit, is, okay, who's the front and who's the back? Who's the left and who's the right? Who's the tail and who's the body? The minute we start talking about this dual creation, which is trying to talk about two things contained together, which is trying to, in a certain sense, encompass the male and the female in a singularity, in describing that, it's inevitable that we're going to be attending to, sensitive to, the asymmetries, front and back, body and tail. Now, I think there's two ways to say it. And the tension to ascribe some kind of negativity to Chava, to the female here, some kind of secondary peripheral status, is certainly constant. And I want to say that the Chazal were very aware and sensitive and intentionally not allowing for that negative interpretation. Working hard against it, which existed very much so in the Hellenistic frame. How can you say woman was created out of a tail to be anything but negative? I think the answer is like this. What was taken from Adam was ancillary. Nothing negative. Adam lost almost nothing in this operation that God did. Adam was essentially complete. That same idea of the completeness of the first creation is here, two faces, meaning we're not talking about genitalia, we're not talking about biological, we're talking about faces, we're talking entire personalities. The zachar v'nekeva is not just an androgynous being, some being that has male and female genitalia to it, which is something that Chazal spoke about and Chazal dealt with, some sort of combined genitalia. But no, the answer is it's two faces. It's entire personalities. The entire complex of male and female is already present. And yet they're separated. Okay, the next verse is just, I want to show you how the attempt to talk about negativity here, that what's the first and what's the last, this being was first for punishment. Okay, the temptation is that Eve now? She's the one who's first for punishment? And pay attention here that the first is being suggested not as privilege, not as the first person out, which would seem to be power, but it's something negative. First being the first one to be punished. And then they go on to say, no, that can't be Eve. The first one to be punished was the snake. And if it's the last one, well, that's Adam. And Chava's right in the middle of the cursings. So we can't ascribe anything negative there. Again, I'd love to delve into this text another time. There's so much there. I just want to extract this double agenda that's being extracted into two. Okay. What's the idea that comes out of this? So there's a kind of beautiful picture that I'd like to describe. If we kind of take it too literally, we have a picture in chapter one of some kind of co-joined twins, some kind of Siamese twins walking around with two faces, if we take that option. And on a certain level, that expresses that the Adam created there had to encompass both sexes. No sex could be left alone because God created it. It has to be there. But imagining it as a kind of monster, this co-joined twins, that is also not the right answer, because how do you sit down? How do you lie down? Meaning, putting the two genders together into a single being is not the answer, because that creates all kinds of difficulties and inefficiencies. There's something that has to be described here, which is much more abstract. And what I'd like to suggest is that the creation in chapter one is a family, is a couple. That God takes the unit of two people together who can, because of their coming together, be creative, be procreative. They're fertile as a couple. They are not fertile individually. And only when they come together can they be addressed with the command, be fruitful and multiply. You need those two halves to come together. It doesn't make sense to address it to one without the other. That follows from the fact that what else was created in chapter one were animals. Meaning we didn't go into lions, tigers, bears. We talked about animals. So the idea that we're talking about a unit, a couple, I think has a lot of merit to it. Sorry, I have to ask you to mute mics. We're not going to take questions now, please. What we're doing is in the second chapter, we zoom into that couple, and they're treated as a unit before, and we say that couple is composed of two halves, things that have things that are present and things that are missing, and they have to come together, brought together, in order for them to function of that Adam unit, which is a couple, a home, a unit together. The analogy which is often given, and people talk about it, is the half shekel. When the Jews were commanded, everybody had to give a bottom basic half shekel, and then there was room for generosity beyond that. These are actual half shekel coins that were found during the Great Rebellion. They are written on it, half shekel, in ancient Hebrew script. Why not just rename it a 50 cent piece? Or call it something else. Call it a nickel, a quarter. Give it a name. What just happened there?
Okay, sorry, that was me. I'm just trying to mute, but I had to reclaim host. I'll put it back in 1 second. I apologize for that.
Okay, no problem. Hi there. I'll keep talking.
Okay, You can go back now, your host. You can share your screen again. I apologize.
No problem. Okay. I hope that's working again. The half shekel. So there's something interesting about a half shekel coin. On one hand, it's a full coin. It's a complete unit. It's there. It's not even though they did talk about taking a coin and cracking it in half and giving it as a half shekel, but it's also possible to have a unit which has a value that we preserve, which suggests the halfness of it, the incompleteness of it. And the fact that we said, why a half shekel? Because every Jewish person is only a half until they come together and complete themselves by finding a mate. One second. Okay. But this, actually, we'll go back. It, kind of looking at the puzzle pieces that I wanted to do, the puzzle piece, I think, is important. The idea that these two halves are not complete, are not equal. They're not the same. That the only way that they would join is that if there is, in a certain sense, a lock and key situation, something which is inserted to something else, so that the boundary of connection, obviously alluding to sexuality, is crossed. If things were kind of complete and whole, two coins, and they come together in a perfect mutuality, there's no joining that's happening there. There has to be something missing in one place and something extra, the basar that was filled in the other place, so that the joining actually happens. And so that the asymmetry of male and female, the inequality, the not perfect, is intrinsic to this question of gender. Two halves which are not the same in all, but their difference is not absolute. It's the ezer kenegdo. It's what's interesting is how they complete each other, how the one has something that the other needs and the other has something that the first needs. And it's that element of gender that is, I think, most important. If we talk about the battery analogy, it's interesting that we think about plus and positive as the positive, right? We have more charge and less charge. Plus means a surplus. But when it comes to electricity, it's actually the opposite. The thing that holds charge is the electron. An electron has a negative charge. So where there's more electrons is actually at the negative pole of the battery. What do I want to say? The more or less is not the point. What's important is the charge that is created when things are not perfectly balanced. When something is taken from one side to the other, there's attraction and there's a desire to come back together and balance that out or be productive to create that whole again. That is a really important point about what we're talking about by conceptualizing gender as halves of a former whole. Okay. But it gets complicated because if we're talking about Adam and that Adam of chapter 1 and saying that Adam is is a couple, well, at certain points, we have to decide who's speaking. How are we going to describe that couple? As something male or something female? Bara oto. Who speaks? Who is the example of it? It's tempting to translate Adam as humanity. And a person spoke quite movingly in the chat of how they were disturbed by the fact that I wasn't doing that in my translation of Adam. And here I want to explain why that's not so simple. Okay, so I want to take you to Adam's fruit store. Okay, and we're going to go back to the fruit analogy and the question of generic versus specific. And we're going to describe the problem this way. Welcome to Adam's fruit store. There's a big sign on front that says Adam's fruit store. And you know exactly what's being sold in this store. This is a place you would come to buy fruit. What kind of fruit? Well, all kinds of fruit. So it's great. All the information I need to know is there. What's missing? I want a representation. Show me the fruit. This is not a very attractive sign. If I want to make it attractive, if I want to make it that pulls people in, if it's an advertisement, it's not enough to give me the information that there's fruit. I want to see the fruit. I want to taste the fruit. I want to know what kind of fruit you're talking about. So you can't put a picture of fruit. You have to pick a specific fruit. You have to embody the fruit. You have to manifest the fruit. It's not possible to make a picture of a fruit. So you pick something. But you pick something as an example. Here's an apple. And it comes with connotations. Maybe I don't like apples. Maybe I think apples are boring. And I determined that Adam's fruit store is a boring fruit store. It just has apples. I'm going to make all kinds of generalizations that extend from the apple, the picture, the example, not the fruit. I know it's a fruit store. But all of a sudden now, getting specific in the show me, in the visual sense, not text, not reading fruit, but in the visual sense of showing me fruit, I have problems. I see an example, and maybe that example attracts, or maybe it repels. So Adam says, no, not apples. Let's do pineapples. So pineapples are exotic. Pineapples are exciting. So he puts a picture of a pineapple up there on his fruit store. Some people like pineapples. Some people conclude that pineapples are too expensive. I'm not going to that, Phil. That's probably a high-end fruit store. They have guava, and I can't get simple apples over there. So there's another message and a whole group of associations with the pineapple here, some of which I intend, some of which I don't intend. So the problem of instancing fruit, getting down to the particular, asking the question, what did it look like, creates immediate problems. And that's sort of what the rabbis were dealing with. What did this Adam look like? Well, it looked like a two-faced being. Well, if you take that too far, you're gonna feel like a two-faced being has all kinds of problems. That's kind of repelling. It doesn't sound like that works very well. If we come back to Adam's fruit store, his only option is to put out a plurality, to have a range of fruit, which suggests the range of possibilities. So in speaking about Adam, in speaking about humankind, the Torah says, Zachar u'nekeva bara otam. It went down and gave examples. And here I'm going to say something strong. You can't meet a human. When you interact with somebody out there, an embodied person, that person is a man or a woman. Meaning, individuals have gender. If I want to talk about humankind, that makes sense as a collective. I could talk about a university, right? The universe of a place where humans come to learn. It's not for men. It's not for women. This is a school for humans. And if I'm talking about the description of a collective, of a set, human is a very good word. But if I told somebody, please pass that fruit over there, That's not how we speak. When I talk about an example of something, I will say that's an apple, that's a banana. When you hold up an apple to a child who's learning words, the child doesn't say, when you ask the question, what's that? A fruit. That the person learns its name, the child learns its name, that's an apple, a banana. A most basic label is man, woman, ish, isha. Humankind, Adam as humankind is important, it's useful, but it doesn't really refer to individuals. Individuals take on a particular gender. Let's kind of place this out and see where this gets other problems. If I would ask you, Adam's Medical School, so who goes there? And if you want to make an attractive sign and put up a picture of Adam's Medical School, who would you pick? So it was interesting. And this actually, this gender question of exemplars of a class is very modern problem. If you Google doctor, what pictures come up? I will tell you that I did it, and I was pleased to find that there was pretty equal representations of men and women for the word doctor. And so putting up a sign of a woman doctor is very fair. In medical school in Israel, women are more than half of the representation in school. And I'm actually proud to say my daughter, Baruch Hashem, just got into medical school herself. So I'm very aware of the possibility of a woman being the exemplar of a doctor. But you have to do one or the other. You're going to make a choice, and that choice is going to come with connotations. Some you want, some you don't want. There's another problem. If we talk about Adam's medical school, so we want to teach about the body. And if the story of creation was talking about a rib, a bone that was created, and bones are there. So if I give examples to you, if we start teaching the human body, so which body are you going to teach? Are you going to teach a male body, or are you going to teach a female body? And what will happen, just the way that we organize knowledge, the way we use language, is that inevitably, there will be a generic exemplar. There will be a skeleton. And the other gender with the changes, and it's certainly true that you can identify the female skeleton. It's the one on the left here, because the pelvis is wider to enable a birthing canal, or a wider birthing canal. So there's a difference. So the question is, listen to the language here. Is the female skeleton a skeleton, a human skeleton that has wider hips? Or is the male skeleton a skeleton which has narrower hips? The skeleton is going to take a place. It has to be embodied. It has to be exampled. Which do you choose? In general, I think the way we work is that the simpler case, the more generic case, which I will make an argument, is fairly assumed to be the male skeleton, because the narrow hips is kind of in the proportion, the side, as you will, is more aligned. And furthermore, the functionality of a male pelvis is more adapted to movement, to optimize movement. And the specialization of the female pelvis to allow its specific female activity, which is birthing, is then adapted at the cost of a certain amount of bipedal motion efficiency. This is called the obstructical dilemma, obstructical dilemma. I knew I would mispronounce that word. And there's a trade-off that's seen between these two different hips. I'd like to say that this is perhaps one possible answer to the question of why female, Isha, was constructed from Adam and not the other way around. Why not start with Isha or Adam, which would be understood to be Isha, and bring a man out of that? Now, I want to be careful, and people will rightly say, Who's to say Adam before the operation was any more man than woman, right? The whole point was it was this two part Sufi creation. So it's not correct to talk about creation of woman from man. And that's true. That's a very fair point. We have to kind of hold on to that Adam piece, but it doesn't completely answer the question, because after the operation, the thing, the person who was taken away was made into the woman. So by extrapolation, by implication, the original was Adam, or was male, or more male. Okay? And maybe that's because the female has an additional level of specialization. And so it's a additional level of adaptation. I don't want to press that point. It could be argued different ways. But what is important is I've attempted, you can tell me if I done a good job or not, to explain difference, to explain first and second, to explain the composite being and the being that was derived carefully, so as to avoid any connotations of better or worse, of less and more. And that, I think, is what the Torah is trying to do, to talk about difference without it being better and worse. Okay, if I wasn't in trouble yet, I'm going to get in trouble now. I really debated whether I would speak to this, but I think it's important. Jesus has a gender, and he's understood to be a man, and he's understood to be a perfect man. So actually, let me go back to set up the point for a second. Why not do this? Why not teach the average skeleton in medical school and then talk about males diverge from the average with their narrow hips and females diverge from the average with the wider hips, that we posit a midpoint between the skeletons of man and woman, and we say men have a little bit narrower and women are a little bit wider than this. Let's talk about a human skeleton as being neither female and neither male. And the answer is because there's no such thing as that. And you run into a much more difficult question is in our desire to not compromise or bias our language of skeletons is we teach nothing. We don't teach an example of anything. If we think about that Adam of being Zachar Unikeva, as Philo did, as the early Hellenists did, as being perfect, and the perfection resided in having no gender, meaning being both genders in a certain sense canceled them out, and so this was a genderless being. I think that is a mistake. I think that's a dangerous drive to go down, to try to equate the sexes by erasing the differences. What the Torah says is both are there, both are present. It's not the absence of gender, it's the presence of both genders, and how that bothness works gets complicated, but that's a better problem to have than removing the gender problem. I will also say, and this I learned from my daughter who's will be studying to be a doctor, that there's a real danger in medical school, that when you teach males as the exemplar of skeletons, you tend to forget the fact that women are different and maybe don't pay attention to the ways in which they do. So yes, there's a problem with this, which is true. In dermatology, right? If you teach the basic dermatology, talking about white people and white skin things that appear, and then talk about the exceptions that apply to darker skins, that has the real danger of letting those exceptions become neglected. So that's very much the problem of gender. I'm not hiding it. But I want to negate the solution. The simple solution is to simply avoid gender talk. And that just invites other problems. Okay. I think to a certain example, that's what we did, or that's what Christianity tried to do in kind of picking up Hellenist ideas in describing what the New Testament calls the Son of God. So who is the Son of God? Is the Son of God male or female? And the New Testament's answer is that it's male. So how are females present in divinity? Are they less than? Are they not godly? And that was a real question, a real problem. And one of the answers is to say that Jesus is not really a man. And so it doesn't exclude. Jesus includes both. Not that he's male and female, but he's neither male or female. And this is I think, very much the problem. If we talk about an individual of trying to be perfect and not lacking anything by being neither gender, then we're going to erase sexuality. Recall that Jesus is understood to be born by immaculate conception. What does that mean? His mother was perfect. What was her perfection? She was a virgin. What does that mean? She was unsullied by being compromised by a man. That perfection is the fact that I remain whole. The idea that it's not two halves of a whole, but wholeness is what needs to be preserved. And that wholeness is by being a individual, which is not sexless. It is not for naught that all the early church fathers spoke about celibacy as an ideal. That priests, you know, certainly in the Catholic tradition, were meant to be, priests and nuns were meant to be celibate. And that Jesus fathers no children. His perfection is the fact that I want to say he remains abstract. He's conceived as being something perfect and a human. So the incompatibility of putting those two things together is again the complication, and you end up denying sexuality, denying fatherhood or motherhood. All in the desire to conceive of an individual as complete as an individual. Okay. I'm going to change gears for now, and move into something that I want to have to do a little bit more quickly. Gender roles. Okay. If there is a difference, then I want to look at this text with you. The text of Sarai. Now, the goal of being fruitful and multiplying, the goal of a family is difficult of forming this unit of fertility. And really the whole story of Bereshit is talking about those difficulties and those challenges. Sarah was infertile. She doesn't have children. What does she do? She takes Hagar, who's an Egyptian, and says to Abraham, please take her. And she will conceive, and somehow I will be built up, that same word, boneh, through her. Abraham complies, and Hagar somehow acts with a certain amount of disrespect towards Sarai. Sarai is upset with Abraham, and Abraham says back, I'm happy to reverse this. Whatever you want to do is yours. Do what you see fit. Then Sarai afflicts her and she flees. She flees. Those words, v'ta'aneha v'tivrach, are really connected to Egypt and our oppression. Inui is what our affliction, and brecha is what we experienced, or what Paro said we said when we left. I don't have time to get into that. Okay. I want to zoom in on this verse. Sarai takes Hagar and gives Hagar to Abraham. And that becomes Isha lo li'isha. We'll come back to that. The taking is a key word. The taking is key for getting married, for acquiring a wife. In the verse here in Devarim, ki kach ish isha, when a man takes a wife and marries her, this is how we learn all about betrothal. the famous Mishnah in Kiddushin says a woman is acquired in three ways: through money, through contract, or through sexual intercourse. And acquires herself, meaning she could also affect this exchange by acquiring herself. I know I'm moving quickly, but I'm trying to make a point here. The Gemara immediately says, where do we learn that money is a way to affect marriage? How does money lead to marriage? And it makes a three-part connection. Here it is written out in English, simplified. The verse says, taking, yikach, taking is a woman. And then it switch gears and talks about the act that Avram does of buying a field. He says, I will give money and you, Ephron, should take it from me. There's a giving and there's a taking, and it's two different people. Avraham gives money, Ephron takes the field. And that is how Avraham acquired the field. So from here we learn that money, through the act of taking, is a way to affect this. What do I want to make by this? So I want to ask an important question. We talked about asymmetries, about differences, and we're going to be very aware of these asymmetries. And the problem is, in this idea of a woman is acquired, it's very off-putting. And I'd like to ask this question. When somebody buys and somebody else sells what that person is buying, who's in charge? The buyer or the seller? The answer, of course, is both. There's a certain reciprocity going on over here. Is it equal? The answer is no. An exchange can never be equal. Somebody is more interested in having this transaction than the other person. How do I know? Let's say you buy a car for $5,000. That's a good deal. You go back to the person who sold you the car and you say, you know what? If this car equals $5,000, I changed my mind. I'd rather have the car. Here's the money back. And the person doesn't agree, because that exchange went in one direction. Somebody, money meant more to them than their car, and the other person's car meant more to them than the money. Meaning there is an asymmetry here, but it's what pushes the transaction. I have something you want. You have something I want. We don't want them the same way. One's more interested in this, one's more interested in that, but that is exactly what affects business. Let's go back to that verse, and I really know that I'm rushing through here for a moment. Sarai takes Hagar and gives it to Abraham. She's doing both actions herself. And that affects the fact, look at these words in Hebrew now, please, very carefully. La Abraham isha lo li isha. There's a play here that I alluded to last week. Avraham is Isha. The first one means Ish Asher La, her husband. It means her husband. And Hagar becomes to Avraham a Isha, a woman, a wife. This play, I think, is really intentional. Watch why I think so. So again, remember the word Isha with a mapike, with the aspirated hay at the end, is a contraction of Ish Asher La, forming the word Isha. Okay. Back in Bereishit. Again, Chava does the same thing. She takes the fruit and gives it to her husband. She's doing all of the action. There's no reciprocity here. She's taking and giving. And the act of doing that, she is the Isha, named Isha, and in close proximity, she becomes or converts Adam into Isha. There's a feminization that's happening of him in this role of being the recipient. That's what I'm reading here. By playing with the real similarities between Isha, woman, wife, and Isha, Ish Shelah. I checked in the concordance, and that's the document that I put up. Someone can, if they're interested, go into this further. There are 41 examples of Isha all through Tanakh. And everyone that I checked, there is this play of gender roles, a kind of subversion of the normal roles. And this is a perfect example. Samson's parents, there's lots of gender issues with Samson and Delilah. But God reveals to Samson's mother, Eshet Manoach. Manoach is his father, and she's unnamed. God reveals himself to Samson's mother and gives her the instructions that Samson is to be a Nazir. She tells her husband. Husband says, I want to hear it for myself. So God hears the voice of Manoach, and this is so humorous, I think, in this reading. He hears the voice of Manoach, and he sends the angel. The angel comes to the Isha, to the woman. Repeats again to the woman. And where is Manoach? Umanoach, Isha. Again, that word is not necessary. Manoach totally identifies who we're talking about. The added Ish Shela, this Isha, this person who is not doing his role properly, Ein Ima, he's not there. So I think this nuance in this read is very much present. Okay. The last point I want to make today is when I say gender roles, and in a certain sense, I'm strengthening them or talking about them as valid constructs, I want to say they're valid constructs in a very specific way. What do I mean? They are roles, exactly what it means. They are scripts that you can avail yourself of. And it's useful to have those defaults, as they were, things that you can play the role. They make sense in terms of certain biology and certain societal needs, and they are defaults. But it is entirely possible to not play the role as Chava does, as Eshet Manoach does, and it's not necessarily wrong. Sometimes it's very much the needed corrective. It's what Sarai does to Abraham. She takes charge of the sexuality in the family. She says there's a problem. In a different instance, she also takes charge of the children in the home and says, again, Hagar and her son Ishmael has to leave. And Abraham says, this is difficult. What should I do? And God instructs Abraham, listen to the role that Sarah is playing. This is a good subversion. This is an important change of roles. And that comes back to the idea of Ezer Kenegdo playing a role and a counter role, a counterpart, a balancing force. Moshe plays a script. And this most incredible pasuk, this most incredible verse, this modern concept, Moshe says, strike me from your book that you wrote, God. It's so self-reflective. It's so modern. Abraham, Moshe, it's recursive. I'm aware that I'm a character in a book. It's like Pirandello. It's I'm aware and I want out. And Moshe has that choice. He's not been written irrevocably into this role. He says, erase me. And God, he threatens, actually. He says, I want out. And God is convinced by this plea, and God says, okay, I'll do what you say, just don't write yourself out of the book. I need you. It's amazing, this statement of how scripts are available but need not be played. And that's how I want to conceptualize gender roles. Okay, we're at the end. I'd like to just summarize if we can. The Torah is addressed to the composite creation Adam, which includes male and female. That composite, the family, the home, the unit, is that most important composite creation. The purpose of Torah is fulfilled in becoming part of a fertile unit. The autonomous individual, right? What I want to say is more the message of the New Testament, is not the goal and object of creation. In this understanding, I don't want to say that easily or flippantly. It's difficult, and for certain people it's not available. They aren't possible to fulfill this? And that's difficult. And it's exactly those challenges, which is the real meat of Bereishit. Infertility is suffered by all the families, couples. And those challenges are really what we're talking about. Gender describes the asymmetries between the parts that are unit created by that separation. And I want to add asymmetry, which does not take the marker of positive or negative, of plus or minus, of better and worse, just an asymmetry. Those asymmetries are relational. I play more nurture to your active role. I'm playing mercy to your strict judgment. I'm funny man to your straight person. This asymmetry is exactly what engenders the exchange and the reciprocity. It's not what stifles things. The desire for perfect equality, I want to say, is what creates stasis and freezes things. Gender differences provide roles that can be adopted and subverted. And the composite creature, Adam, is an abstraction. You can't meet that Adam, that two-faced being. There, he's not available to walk around. Real people have gender. Humanity describes a whole class. People, however, are men and women. And, you know, it's a joke, but it's a real problem. People says, I love humanity. It's people that drive me crazy. So there's a kind of derivation here, right? I wish I could deal with humans. It's just men and women that are the problem. And that desire to run away from the complications of gender, I think, is futile and ill-advised. Okay, that's my presentation. I'm going to take some time now to look at the chat and see if we can pick up certain things. I know people do have to go, and that's all right. And let's see. Actually, let me stop the share and come back just regular with the screen here. Rabbi Kelman, you made it through the whole thing. You said you weren't going to make it. Did I
captivate? I said I wasn't sure.
Okay. I'm happy to see you here. Sorry, I'm just going to turn my just a regular Zoom on for a second. Give me a chance. Sorry.
You see all the questions, right? All the comments in the chat box?
Yeah, I see them and I can access them. I just wanted to put my camera back on. There we go. Okay. Questions, points. Here we go. And again, I really thank everybody out there for joining us. I really very much do value your friendship. It is difficult being on this very unilateral kind of teaching thing. I did try to keep to my 1 hour time frame, and this is now optional, let's say. I'm going to the creations now, the questions now. Right, it starts with Hakim. This is why I create the avatar I'm using today. I'll have to look at the avatar to see what that is referring to. Okay, there's that sources. If anybody wants to go through the 41 examples, they're welcome to. I put it up in the chat. Naaseh, notwithstanding Chazal, it is simply that the subject of the verb to do is Elokim, which is a plural noun, but the subject of the verb is to say is a singular. Yes, there's certainly something going on here with Elokim being plural. Now, again, nowhere else is Elokim, when it refers to God, used as a plural, but that the pluralness of Elohim is certainly present over there. I just want to repeat what I think is very nice is that if humans are being created in the image of God and the creation is a plurality, there's something I think very suggestive about in this particular context, the plurality of God is being emphasized, that Tselem is the many possible Tselems, the proportions of a male and a female are there. Okay, thank you for your comments. B, building the side inscribed the woman Mishkan seems to suggest that the woman represents the holy space. Yes, I think that's certainly true. Shekhinah is related with the feminine. The inhabiting of the holy space with Shekhinah is certainly there. In the Mishkan, the parochet, the curtain which separated the Kodesh Kodeshim and the Kodesh, has the two poles of the Aron poking through. And Chazal described that curtain like the two breasts of a woman. So the femininity of the Shekhinah, of the Mishkan, of that building is absolutely part of the message. So that's, thank you for bringing that up. Okay, so I see the question of a homosexual couple, two loving human beings, well, maybe not, for whatever reason, can't procreate. So this we'll speak about more about. It is absolutely true that there are two separate things going on here in the story of creation. The loneliness of man is being alluded to and being alleviated by the finding of his couple. And the ability to procreate is also there, one being more the emphasis of chapter one and one being more the emphasis of chapter two. So the love and the coupling and the emotional mood and the existential of coming together is separate from, but not independent of. And that's, I think, where the message is. Absolutely, you know, two people who don't have children form a loving unit. They form something. It is God's desire that people not be alone. That's certainly true. I will still argue that there is still an advantage a reaching more of an ideal when that couple also succeeds in bringing children into the world, when all those things which are nested, they don't exist as separate units, but when a home succeeds in creating the emotional connection, the existential connection, the biological connection, and parents are stakeholders at every level, that is something that is, I think, held to be an ideal. Not to say that it can't be reached or aspired to in all kinds of other ways as well. Again, I'm speaking delicately around a complicated topic, but that's what I want to say here. Okay, 60% of medical school, yeah, are female. Adam is a boy's name. He's a female name. That is the way it is in biblical areas. It's true. The common understanding that Adam was the male is the simplest way to read it, that female was created and brought to Adam. But this, you know, the Adam of chapter one having both male and female is certainly there, and it's complicated. Wider hips is only part of the anatomy. The hip girdle is tilted more in female. Yes, there are certainly many other differences in terms of hip width, but what I read, and you know, I'm expert by no means, that there is something called the obstetrical dilemma, which is this evolutionary trade-off, and that somehow it is better for birthing and a little less efficient in terms of bipedal motion. I don't know. I do know that is debated. The obstetrical dilemma is not a simple thing, and I know it's not accepted by everyone. Oh, that's interesting. The crash tech dummies things. Yeah, I think that's certainly true. This proto-human created chapter one that Holly's suggesting, I I'm not sure what you gain by that. I want to be very careful about not having something real, which is not functional. You're sort of speaking to the problem, right? The idea that God created something and finished creating it in chapter one, to me is better resolved by talking about both genders being present. I think that addresses the difficulties as I try to explain. most of this putting is from Jesus. It's what I said about Jesus is just a straight read from the New Testament. It's the text itself. What the history is there, you know, I don't want to get into it, whether that was or wasn't. It's a reading of the text, however that text came to be, and definitely speaks to large general elements. And I'm very well aware that Christianity is a very complex picture, and there's all sorts of elements that are there, some much closer to Judaism in their ideas of sexuality and some further from Judaism. And even within Judaism, there are things that are more ascetic and things that are less ascetic. So yes, when you go down to the details, it becomes very difficult to make that divide. But in big strokes, I do believe that my general division about the tension between Jew and Christianity bears out on this gender issue. Okay. Celibacy was adopted either church to stem loss of papacy or divorces, not for pursuit. I disagree. Celibacy was a concept. Virginity was a concept. Preserving virginity is an ideal. The idea of Mary being a virgin, Immaculate Conception, is all part of this preserving of perfection, of the avoiding of celibacy. So Jesus is not recorded to have any children. We don't. All the fathers, all the avos, all the imaot, we know that they were effective males. It's part of the story. Circumcision is the first mitzvah, meaning the locus of operation. We know that Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had penises that worked. We don't know that about Jesus. Could be, could not be. The point is, it's not the story. And that's really what I want to say. Okay. You're making a distinction between Immaculate Conception and a virgin birth. Thank you. Again, they're certainly related in their idea that somehow sexuality is a negative to be avoided, but there's distinctions there that I'm happy to learn more about. The take give Isha starts in Gan Eden with, yeah, well, I came back to that. So yeah. You anticipated me. The first role of the woman taking charge. That's a good point. that is a good point. Part of it is that it is wrapped up with the sin of Eitz Hadat. So whether it was positive or not positive, you know, how that goes is certainly... certainly something. I will also point out that in the creation of man, God does the taking, right? God takes the rib, and Adam is completely passive. He's in a deep sleep there. So that's also, Adam is in the role of being slept with, if you will, as the rib is being taken from him. So he does in the creation play the receptive role, if you will. But fair point. Thank you. People are men and women. Yes, there are many accounts of forms stand of Jesus having married. Yes, but it matters that those accounts of Jesus marrying and having children are really apocryphal, are really outside the canon, aren't lived or embodied, aren't taught. Meaning, there, you know, lots of ideas are current, certainly in Judaism as well. And again, what I'm saying was it was absolutely an oversimplification on many levels, but I don't think it's invalid, right? The fact that the basic text is there is no account of Jesus' children, and there's account of Moses' children and Abraham's children, and we, children is the topic, is I think still too big of a distinction to leave. The we of Brayshon wants to create is the plural. Yeah, good point there. I'm at the end. I think I'm at the end. Okay. Thank you, everybody. Let me just look at it again. The we of Brayshit, who wants to create Adam in their image, is the plural. Oh, so you wrote that point that I came back to later, Ruth, right? Talking about the parallel. So you anticipate that point. Thank you. Yeah, that was the point I tried to make at the end. Thank you, everybody. I do hope you enjoyed. If you do have feedback or want to share points, I'm going to put my email right into the chat right now. You're welcome to do that. This is my email. Otherwise, we will see you next week, I hope. There's my email. If you want to continue the conversation, can't guarantee a quick or even complete response to everybody, but it didn't come up. Oh, no, you're right. I did it to just one person. I'm sorry. I'll do it again. There we go. Did that come through now?
Nope.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So if anybody wants to continue offline, I'm happy. Thank you all for joining, and we will see you, Bezrat Hashem, same time, same bat channel, same bat place, next week, Tuesday at 5.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, at 1 p.m., of course, Rabbi Shulman, just to let you know, those are still here, that Rabbi Shulman's class on Sefer Daniel is going to end next week. Like this week and next week, because that's two classes that have been going on most of the year. And then he's going to take a one-week break. And then when we start our Elul Zman, he will be giving a series on Kohelet, which we have never done before. And it's a very complex book, as we all know. Anyways, okay, and then tomorrow, Rabbi Blau on Agadah. I think tomorrow it's the relationship between Agadah and Halakha. Okay, look forward to learning with you. And he's your neighbor, Rabbi, right?
Three doors down, yeah.
Three doors down. We have like half of a lunch food, comes to Torah Motion, you know. It's like, lunch food is like living in a ivory tower and then some, I think. No?
I hope I don't, you know, lose touch.
But it's, you know, a little bit,
not a compliment.
No, I meant it as a, whatever, it's a serious place of learning, but, you know, it's not a business place. You want to make lots of money in business. That's, you don't move to lunch food.
That is
you
true,
want to sit and learn, you move to lunch food.
They let bums like me in too. So.
I'm sorry?
They let bums like me in too. So.
Yeah, whatever. Okay. All right. Very, very well. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Rachel, you want to stay for a second?
If you had your bar mitzvah in Rabbi Kelman's father's shul, does the name Silver Heart mean anything to you?
Art Silver.
Silver Heart. S. Silver Heart. Last name, Silver Heart.
No, I'm sorry.
What year was your bar mitzvah?
70.
Oh, okay.
No, 1980, excuse me.
Oh, you're very much younger. My cousins belong to that shul. My cousins remember Rabbi Kelman, the one who was just with us, as a little red-headed terror running around shul.
Well, he's just a couple years older than me. His younger brother Maury is my age, and I remember the kids there as well. But My contemporaries were Moshe Lambert. Do you remember? Is that a name?
Yeah, I know him. I went to yeshiva. I learned in yeshiva with him. I think.
Oh, Chappelle's?
At Chappelle's, yeah.
Yeah, I think he was there at Chappelle's.
Yeah, yeah, I know him. But I'm much older than he is. He's a young fellow.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's way older. And my cousins are my age or younger, but they're much younger than me.
No, I don't. Maybe my parents would remember.
Silver Heart. It wasn't a common name.
Yeah.
Isn't a common name.
I will ask my parents.
My cousin Tommy had a health food store downtown called Naturally Yours. It still exists, but it's not downtown anymore because of COVID. Naturally Yours. But anyway.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Rabbi? That's... Rabbi? Do you hear me? I'd like to share something with you. In the world of Christianity, there's a distinction between Jesus having come into the world via the virgin birth, but Mary, his mother, is the belief that the Virgin Mary was free of original sin from the moment of her conception, and the Immaculate Conception refers to Mary's coming into the world, not Jesus's.
Okay, is that across the board, or that's one reading?
That is one reading, but it's interesting. Many Christians actually believe that Jesus was the product of Immaculate Conception, but that phrase is reserved exclusively for Mary.
For her birth.
Her coming into the world. She was free of original sin because of the Immaculate Conception, but the phrase Immaculate Conception does not apply to Jesus. And you certainly can, you know, research this out on the internet in a variety of areas of research, but it's a clear distinction, and it's not controversial. Immaculate Conception exclusively applies to Mother Mary.
Okay, I will just kind of return to my more general point, which is even just talking about original sin and however it's expressed, whether the Immaculate Conception of Mary or the virgin birth of Jesus, is all part of this kind of global sense of attaching a certain amount of negativity to sexuality, which in the global sense of what I'm trying to say is a distinction between the New Testament and the Torah.
Now, it's also interesting that the concept.
Is that fair to say if I say it that way?
That would be reasonably fair with a couple considerations, though. Celibacy did not come in. Celibacy for the Catholic clergy did not come into play until maybe sometimes in the Middle Ages. And it came into play because there were even popes that were married and priests that were married. But celibacy was actually imposed because they did not want the transfer of church property to go to the children of the priests. So if there's celibacy, there's not going to be children, so you don't have to worry about church property being transferred to children.
I mean, that may be independently true, but the valorization of celibacy is there at the beginning. Paul in the New Testament advocates celibacy. The original church fathers, Justin Martyr, they're celibate. Across the board, they're celibate. And they advocate it. Even those that have the most positive inclination towards sexuality, like Justin Martyr, nonetheless say it is still preferable to be celibate. So
it's interesting, though. The apostles, I think
much,
most of the apostles.
It's much earlier.
Yeah. So I just want to share these thoughts, and it's been a wonderful presentation. So thank you for all the work you put into your presentations.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your feedback.
Thank you. Bye-bye.